This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Ricky Lee Chavez. She is legislative coordinator with the New Mexico Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And Ben Bauer joins us. He is past president of that association. He is Santa Fe's district defender with the Law Office of the Public Defender. And we're here to talk about the legislative session and the bills that have to do specifically with crime and the rights of criminals and the public. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
It's great to have you. Now, let's do a little bit of an overview of what the organization is and what your goals are during a legislative session like this one.
New Mexico Criminal Defense Lawyers Association is a professional organization. We have several hundred members. Maybe Ricky knows the number.
It's about 500.
And members are public defenders or private attorneys from across the state.
And so they are basically tasked with allowing a person who's accused of a crime with a fair trial.
Correct. And the Public Defender's Office, of course, represents the vast majority of people who cannot afford a private attorney and yet face criminal charges.
So when we're looking at the legislative session, there is a focus this session on some crime bills that I guess are favored by the governor. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Let's talk about some of those bills. One of them that was really popular all over the country sort of like 20 years ago, I think, was the three strikes you're out law. First of all, what does three strikes you're out mean? Do we have something like that now in New Mexico?
Yeah, sure. I can definitely answer that for you. New Mexico currently does have a three strikes law. It is essentially meant to capture the worst of the worst, those people who commit three what New Mexico law has outlined as violent felonies. And if you are charged and convicted with three of these enumerated violent felonies, you are sentenced to serve a life sentence here in New Mexico.
So we have laws like this now. What is being considered that goes beyond what we already have?
So there are two House bills introduced that would extend our current three strikes law. First, I'll talk about HB 56, introduced by Representative Paul Pacheco. This law pushes to include 12 more felonies into our current statute. And what that would do would expand the number of people who could qualify for this three strikes, you're out life sentence.
And what would those additions be?
So there are several additions. I can talk briefly about a couple of them. Before, it was really specific to murder, first degree and second degree murder. Now it will include voluntary and involuntary manslaughter, different levels of burglary, different levels of battery, also assault on a police officer, assault with a deadly weapon on a police officer, shooting at a dwelling from a vehicle, basically several felonies that are beyond the first and second degree class of felony.
Now, involuntary manslaughter, that's the kind of thing where you're driving your car, you hit somebody by mistake, and then you'd be able to go to jail for life?
That would be essentially one of the strikes.
Oh, that would be one. So that would have to happen three times. Okay.
Yeah.
And so how does your organization view this bill and the expansion of the number of felonies?
Well, let me start to answer that. Each one of these things is obviously a crime. It's a felony. If somebody's convicted, they face prison time, many years of prison time. New Mexico also has an habitual offender statute. And what that means is that if somebody has a felony conviction, picks up another felony, they're punished for that. So we already have a graduated sentencing scheme, which has been around for decades. And it can be applied, and it is applied. So the idea that somehow there's a group of people who commit crimes over and over and there's no penalty for that, I think, is misguided.
So you're saying that this law is trying to solve a problem that doesn't exist?
The problem of people committing violent crimes definitely exists. The question is what you do about it. And increasing sentences, especially with life sentences, has been shown over and over again to be not only not effective, but counterproductive in many ways, and incredibly costly.
Now, how is it counterproductive?
When you increase sentences to this point, people that might be able to be rehabilitated are sitting in prison for years or decades. And in this case, let's think about what a life sentence means for a minute. Many violent crimes are committed by young men. Unfortunately, there's a rise in the commission of crimes that are violent by young women as well, according to the statistics. But at some point, the time period in someone's life when they're doing this ends. Whether that's in their late 30s, in their 40s, people stop committing violent crimes at some point. If they're in a life sentence with no hope of parole, then we're talking about 30, 40, 50 years of incarceration of someone who doesn't need to be there. And not only is that bad for them, of course, it's bad for their family, but it's really bad for society because people can be reformed. And think about what an old person in prison looks like and what that means. It means somebody who needs increased medical care, who loses touch with their families, and who has lost, I mean, they've lost everything. And we have to take care of them. Instead of letting them get out, instead of giving them a chance to look forward and reform, we've completely slammed that door forever.
There's another related issue that the laws under consideration don't really speak to, but that is the problem of people who are in prison increasingly being warehoused there rather than rehabilitated there.
Yes.
And that's very much the case. And there are well-meaning people who are trying to bring programs into prison, who are trying to address mental health issues, trying to address substance abuse issues. But that is not the forum where this is really most effective. And it's incredibly costly. And so far, society hasn't been willing to invest in that.
Right. So meanwhile, when I said trying to address a problem, that this three strikes you're outlaw is trying to address a problem that doesn't exist, what I was trying to say was responding to your comment that we already have habitual offender laws, and so this is basically another habitual offender law that is redundant on the ones that we already have?
Well, and it takes it one step further, because many of these crimes that are being added in this three strikes bill don't fit into our current definition of what constitutes a violent crime. So you're throwing out this really broad net and you're catching a lot of people with the addition of these crimes that have shown no proclivity for violence, which is what some of the proponents of this law are saying this law is going to do. It's going to catch the most violent offenders. But many of these crimes, like the example that you also pointed out with involuntary manslaughter, there doesn't need to be any sort of violence shown on the offender to be charged and essentially convicted with that crime. It can be an accident where somebody ran a red light, they hit another vehicle, three people were killed. That's involuntary manslaughter. There was no intent to be violent. And like I said, you have this broad net where you're sweeping all of these nonviolent people up and punishing them as if they had shown this proclivity for violence.
I think these are interesting issues because, of course, they're hot-button issues. Nobody wants to be the victim of any violent crime. Nobody wants to be the victim of burglary or robbery or any of these things. And we get scared. You know, citizens who aren't committing those crimes and aren't in those circles get scared of those things. And so I think it's very important to talk about them in detail and not act out of fear. And another one of those issues is child pornography, which is not a beautiful thing. there's at least one bill. Is it one or more bills that are being considered on the issue of child pornography this session?
It's one bill, and it is House Bill 65, introduced by Representative Sarah Maestas Barnes.
And what does it say?
To give you a little bit of background, a couple years ago, there was a case involving child pornography before the New Mexico Supreme Court, and it highlighted an issue with how our current child pornography statute is written, and that it needed to be readdressed and potentially reworked. So the Attorney General of New Mexico is backing this legislation through Representative Maestas Barnes, and their proposed solution to this statutory issue is to charge anybody who possesses one image of child pornography with one count of child pornography. You can see how in this day and age that would be incredibly problematic, in that we now live in a very technologically advanced era where people can store massive amounts of media on their computers, on their cell phones, on flash drives. And so what this proposed legislation would do is somebody who possesses, say, 1,000 images would be charged with 1,000 counts. And those are felony counts. And so they're looking at this massive amount of time if they're convicted of possessing these 1,000 images.
Very interesting. Now, how does the law read now?
At this point, people can be charged and had been charged in the past per image for each count. And there was a court case which said that that was not necessarily the way to go and disallowed somebody's conviction for many of those counts.
Oh, okay. So help me out here for a second. The old law said you could charge 1,000 felony counts for 1,000 images, and the new law says the same thing?
Well, it's addressing what the proponents consider a loophole, but we consider just an issue that's arisen because of technology, where the court was concerned with overcharging because of the number of images, not necessarily equating to the amount of harm done or the actual acts of the defendant.
Okay. And so you oppose this proposed legislation. What do you think would be good legislation?
Well, I think that is a bit of a complex question, in that there are several ideas out there, and it's going to come down to hopefully some sort of compromise between the proponents and other interested organizations like NMCDLA, like the Law Office of the Public Defender. We fortunately have a great attorney who actually litigated this issue before the Supreme Court, and she has proposed several suggested amendments so that we don't end up with one image per one count. Some of the proposals have been something like a number, 1 to 10, one count, something like that. That's not exactly what the amendment would be, but to give you an idea of what some of our suggested amendments or fixes for this.
And there's been some interest in this from the other side as well, because the problem is, back in the day, people, I'm not sure how they got it, but we're not defending the use or especially the production of child pornography.
Definitely not.
But somebody might send away or mail something to someone else, and there might be an envelope with one or two pictures in it, we would assume. Now with computers, at the touch of a button, somebody might download 100, 1,000. It's a terrible thing, but for them to face, hundreds, thousands of years in prison, whereas somebody who commits a murder faces, 9 years, 30 years, it's out of proportion. And remember, these people are still looking at prison time, often for the rest of their lives, and registration as sex offenders.
Let me ask a question. What is the harm to society of somebody who is observing child pornography but has never hurt anybody? I mean, we know that pedophilia is a real kind of mental illness that's very, very hard to treat or to cure or to change. But if some, guy, weirdo, is sitting in his house looking at this stuff and never leaves his house, why would he go to jail for 10,000 years or whatever?
I think the issue stems to demand. If there wasn't this demand or search for these types of images, then people would not be supplying them or going out of, you know, making that potentially their career to make this type of material.
And there's a concern that that person may go on to actually commit acts, the viewing of child pornography. Now, I'm not sure what the science of that is and whether it's really been proven or not.
Right. And so we may have a case where there's not actually a proven link between one thing and another, and yet it's like, what if I were a journalist doing a story on child pornography and I downloaded images to see what it looked like? Would I then be a potential felon?
There's a lot of concern about that. In fact, attorneys handling these images, both as prosecutors and defense attorneys, have been very concerned about this in the past because of the very low standard of intent. And so we've had to take extraordinary measures to work these cases without ourselves committing crimes. So if it's a problem for us, it would have to be a problem for the person on the street or sitting at their computer.
This is very tricky business because nobody, I mean, from the production end, if there are children being abused, which is sort of to be assumed if somebody is producing child pornography, I can see how that would be a major felony.
And this does not address that crime. That the production of child pornography and especially the actual child abuse is a very serious crime and a completely different issue.
Okay.
Yeah, this law and our current law only addresses possession.
So possession of something, in a way, it's sort of like, I don't know, tell me if this is true. Is it analogous to people possessing a drug that they themselves use but is not necessarily of harm to anybody else?
It could be. There's always the question of what the harm is to the victim, to the child, who originally, whether it was the week before, the year before, a decade before, had this happen to them, and whether they know that this image is out there and how that affects them. That's been one of the arguments that's been raised.
So that is the whole issue of child pornography, and we should talk about this more on the Radio Cafe in the future because it is very complicated, but you, as the New Mexico Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, are opposing the bill as it is currently written.
Yes, we are, and there has been some hope to sit down with the proponents of the bill, with other people who are opposing the bill, and so that we can come to some sort of compromise, some sort of agreement, something hopefully, and this is, you know, pie in the sky hope, that everybody can agree is the best fix for this issue that the New Mexico Supreme Court has pointed out.
So let's move on to DWI, driving while intoxicated. We now have a situation where, for example, medical marijuana is legal. Does intoxication, and there are some bills before the legislative session right now, does intoxication include or have any standards to include anything besides alcohol?
It does. The DWI statute includes being under the influence of alcohol or being impaired by any drug to the degree that you cannot safely operate a vehicle.
And so what is the bill that is before the legislature now?
So the bill that's being proposed selects several drugs that are generally illegal, street drugs for the most part, and sets a per se limit. It selects a numerical amount of drugs in the bloodstream and says that if a person has that amount of drugs in their bloodstream, they are impaired.
And so it goes, there's a list of every conceivable drug, let's say, or?
Correct. And, you know, some of them are marijuana, amphetamines or methamphetamines, heroin or other kinds of opiates, that kind of stuff.
Yes, this year it's House Bill 44, introduced by Representative William Bill Ream, and it would include almost, I think it's six different drugs and their levels that would used as a per se intoxication level.
And so what's wrong with that?
The problem with that is, first of all, that there's no science behind it. They've selected these levels, and I invite people to ask how they selected them.
How did they select them?
My understanding is that these levels are the lowest detectable levels where they can say that there is definitely that amount of drugs in the bloodstream. There are no scientific studies which tie them into a particular kind of impairment. They are not necessarily tied to what are considered therapeutic levels for some of these drugs, which people get prescriptions for, including marijuana, including certain kinds of opiates.
And so it's basically if there's any so that'd be like if you had one glass of wine 2.5 hours ago and it's detectable in your bloodstream, then that would count. It's equivalent to that.
That's correct. The way it works now is, and we have these kinds of cases. I mean, with the Public Defender's Office, we handle thousands of DWI cases around the state. People are convicted of driving under the influence of marijuana. People are convicted of driving under the influence of heroin. A police officer pulls up behind a car that's in a traffic lane. It's stopped in the lane. An officer approaches the driver's side, and a person is slumped over the steering wheel with a needle in their arm.
Right.
That person is driving under the influence of heroin. It can be charged. It can be proven. They can give field sobriety tests. They have video. They have the video cameras in the police car. They have their lapel cameras, hopefully. These cases are charged, and people should not be driving under the influence. That can be very damaging to society. It can be dangerous. But people driving simply with some amount of a drug in their bloodstream is not impairment.
And would you favor something like that being written if there were science? I mean, are we moving in that direction toward having that kind of science?
Well, the problem with having that kind of science is alcohol is legal to consume. It is, you can consume alcohol. You can consume alcohol in a study and then be tested to see when you start to become impaired because of how much alcohol you consume. Some of the drugs that are in this bill, it is illegal to consume any amount. So you run into this, like Ben was saying, the science is missing. You can't have a study where you allow people to consume an illegal narcotic to see at what level they become impaired.
Right, yeah, let's do a double-blind control study about safe levels of heroin. I don't think so.
Correct.
However, marijuana, that is conceivable.
And I think they're going to move towards that. The question is, what is impairment also? Again, people are prescribed certain drugs to address psychological issues, to address medical issues, and the mere use of those, which are otherwise illegal, doesn't necessarily impair you.
Another consideration in the legislature this year, where the main purpose of this session is to establish a budget for the coming fiscal year, is funding. And of course, everybody's clamoring for the same dollars, and some of them are non-existent dollars because we didn't have the revenues that were forecast. Nevertheless, I mean, we can talk about, it's sort of like medicine. You can talk about prevention and you can talk about treatment. There's certain kinds of funding that I know you guys are supporting, for example, for behavioral health services, where if that funding is there, you save a lot of money in the long run, because if people have the mental health treatment they need, they don't necessarily end up in the system.
There's really a revolving door, especially at the lower level, nonviolent level, of people with serious mental health issues going in and out of jail. And if we cut funding for the services for those people, we end up actually spending a lot more on their incarceration.
Yeah. So protecting funding for behavioral health services seems like a no-brainer, but that, like everything else, is on the chopping block. Also, the Public Defender's Office itself is very important because we have a constitutional right to a lawyer.
Exactly. And this year, with so much legislation that has been introduced that is aimed at increasing penalties, increasing types of crime, the three strikes, the child pornography, these are going to put huge strains on the public defender, on the assistant district attorney, on the Department of Corrections. These organizations that will inevitably be swamped with some of these increased penalty type bills.
And what people, a lot of people don't understand, that the public defender's office represents, you know, the huge majority of people charged with crimes. And we represent people who are innocent. A lot of people don't really understand that until someone that they know, a family member or a friend, is charged with something. Police officers acting in good faith can make mistakes. Prosecutors acting in good faith can make mistakes. It's the job of the defense attorney to look at that, to weigh the evidence, and to get that information to the system. And if that arm of this is not funded, you actually end up spending a lot more money on incarceration, and you know, families are torn apart. The needs of mental health and substance abuse, those kinds of needs just aren't addressed and aren't met.
Yeah, and innocent people end up in jail, which is really anathema to a free and democratic country.
Right, so we need the resources to be able to address that, to be able to get out front, to be able to see people at the jail, to file motions, to get them out if they are innocent or if something else can be done, if there are alternative sentencings that cost less and have a better chance of success for both our client and society at large.
Ben Bauer is past president of the New Mexico Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. He's Santa Fe's district defender with the Law Office of the Public Defender. Ricky Lee Chavez is legislative coordinator for the association, which is on the web at nmcdla.org. And we will keep up with these issues during the course of this session. And as time goes by, I want to thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.